is not wise to let them sit in sunlight, even for a short time. Once the fire begins within, the heat causes the substance to expand violently and the jar shortly fly to pieces. If other jars should happen to be stored in the same vicinity, those go up as well. And so, how many jars do you have at present? This morning, the wisdom Munsiter told me that we had 7,840. That count includes 4,000 jars from King Ares' day, to be sure. Are over ripe fruits.
Halen bobbed his head.
Wisdom Meliard believes we shall be able to provide a full 10,000 jars, as was promised the Queen. I concur.
The pyromancer looked indecently pleased with that prospect. Assuming our enemies give you the time. The pyromancers kept their recipe for wildfire a closely guarded secret, but Tyrion knew that it was a lengthy, dangerous, and time-consuming process. He had assumed the promise of 10,000 jars was a wild boast, like the bannerman who vows to marshal 10,000 swords for his lord and shows up on the day of battle with 102.
If they can truly give us 10,000...
He did not know whether he ought to be delighted or terrified.
Perhaps a smidgen of both. I trust that your guild brothers are not engaging in any unseemly haste, Wisdom. We do not want 10,000 jars of defective wildfire, not even one. And we most certainly do not want any mishaps.
There will be no mishaps, my Lord Hand. The substance is prepared by trained acolytes in a series of bare stone cells, and each jar is removed by an apprentice and carried down here the instant it is ready. Above each work cell is a room filled entirely with sand. A protective spell has been laid on the floors, most powerful. Any fire in the cell below causes the floors to fall away, and the sand smothers the blaze at once.
Not to mention the careless acolyte.
By spell, Tyrion imagined Halen meant clever trick. He thought he would like to inspect one of these false ceiling cells to see how it worked. But this was not the time. Perhaps when the war was won.
My brethren are never careless, Halen insisted. If I may be, frank, Odul. The substance flows through my veins and lives in the heart of every pyromancer. We respect its power. But the common soldier, the crew of one of the Queen's Spitfires, say, in an unthinking frenzy of battle, any little mistake can bring catastrophe. That cannot be said too often. My father often told King Ares as much as his father told old King Jaehaerys.
They must have listened, Tyrion said. If they had burned the city down, someone would have told me. So your counsel is that we had best be careful.
Be very careful, said Halen. Be very, very careful. These clay jars, do you have an ample supply?
We do, my lord, and thank you for asking.
You won't mind if I take some, then? A few thousand?
A few thousand?
Or however many your guild can spare without interfering with production.
It's empty pots I'm asking for, understand?
Have them sent round to the captains on each of the city gates.
I will, my lord, but why?
Tyrion smiled up at him.
When you tell me to dress warmly, I dress warmly. When you tell me to be careful, well...
He gave a shrug.
I've seen enough. Perhaps you would be good enough to escort me back to my litter?
It would be my great, pleasure, my lord.
Halen lifted the lamp and led the way back to the stairs.
It was good of you to visit us. A great honor, It has been too long since the King's Hand graced us with his presence. Not since Lord Rossart, and he was of our order. That was back in King Ares' day. King Ares took a great interest in our work.
King Ares used you to roast the flesh off his enemies. His brother Jamie had told him a few stories of the Mad King and his pet pyromancers.
Joffrey will be interested as well, I have no doubt.
Which is why I'd best keep him well away from you.
It is our great hope to have the King visit our guild hall in his own royal person. I have spoken of it to your royal sister. A great feast.
It was growing warmer as they climbed.
His Grace has prohibited all feasting until such time as the war is won.
At my insistence,
the King does not think it fitting to banquet on choice food while his people go without bread.
A most loving gesture, my lord. Perhaps instead, some few of us might call upon the King at the Red Keep. A small demonstration of our powers, as it were, to distract His Grace from his many cares for an evening. Wildfire is but one of the dread secrets of our ancient order. Many and wondrous are the things we might show you.
I will take it up with my sister. Tyrion had no objection to a few magic tricks, but Joff's fondness for making men fight to the death was trial enough. He had no intention of allowing the boy to taste the possibilities of burning them alive. When at last they reached the top of the steps, Tyrion shrugged out of his shadowskin fur and folded it over his arm. The guild hall of the alchemists was an imposing warren of black stone, but Halen led him through the twists and turns until they reached the gallery of the iron torches, a long echoing chamber where the columns of green fire danced round black metal columns 20 feet tall. Ghostly flames shimmered off the polished black marble of the walls and floor and bathed the hall in an emerald radiance. Tyrion would have been more impressed if he hadn't known that the great iron torches had only been lit this morning in honor of his visit and would be extinguished the instant the doors closed behind him. Wildfire was too costly to squander. They emerged atop the broad, curving steps that fronted on the Street of the Sisters near the foot of Visenya's Hill. He bid Halen farewell and waddled down to where Timmit, son of Timmit, waited with an escort of burned men. Given his purpose today, it had seemed a singularly appropriate choice for his guard. Besides, their scars struck terror in the hearts of the city rabble. That was all to the good these days. Only 3 nights past, another mob had gathered at the gates of the Red Keep, chanting for food. Joff had unleashed a storm of arrows against them, slaying 4, and then shouted down that they had his leave to eat their dead, winning us still more friends. Tyrion was surprised to see Bronn standing beside the litter as well. "What are you doing here?"
"Delivering your messages," Bronn said. "Ironhand wants you urgently at the Gate of the Gods. He won't say why, and you've been summoned to Maegor's too."
"Summoned?" Tyrion knew of only one person who would presume to use that word. "And what does Cersei want of me?"
Bronn shrugged. "The Queen commands you to return to the castle at once and attend her in her chambers. That stripling cousin of yours delivered the message. 4 heirs on his lip, and he thinks he's a man."
4 heirs and a knighthood. His Sir Lancel now, never forget.
Tyrion knew that Sir Jaslyn would not send for him unless the matter was of some import.
"I'd best see what Bywater wants. Inform my sister that I will attend her on my return."
"She won't like that," Bronn warned.
"Good. The longer Cersei waits, the angrier she'll become, and angry makes her stupid. I much prefer anger and stupid to composed and cunning."
Tyrion tossed his folded cloak into the litter, and Timmit helped him up after it. The market square inside the Gate of the Gods, which in normal times would have been thronged with farmers selling vegetables, was near deserted when Tyrion crossed it. Sir Jaslyn met him at the gate and raised his iron hand in brusque salute.
"My lord, your cousin, Cleosfrey, is here, come from Riverrun under a peace banner with a letter from Robb Stark."
"Peace terms?"
"So he says."
"Sweet cousin, show me to him."
The gold cloaks had confined Sir Cleos
to a windowless guardroom in the gatehouse. He rose when they entered.
Tyrion, you are most welcome sight.
That's not something I hear often, cousin.
Has Cersei come with you?
My sister is otherwise occupied. Is this Stark's letter? He plucked it off the table. Sir Jaslyn, you may leave us. Bywater bowed and departed.
I was asked to bring the offer to the Queen Regent, Sir Cleos said as the door shut.
I shall. Tyrion glanced over the map that Robb Stark had sent with his letter. All in good time, cousin. Sit, rest. You look gaunt and haggard. He looked worse than that, in truth.
Yes, Sir Cleos lowered himself onto a bench. It is bad in the Riverlands, Tyrion. Around the God's Eye and along the King's Road especially. The River Lords are burning their own crops to try and starve us. And your father's foragers are torching every village they take and putting the small folk to the sword.
That was the way of war. The small folk were slaughtered while the highborn were held for ransom.
Remind me to thank the gods that I was born a Lannister.
Sir Cleos ran a hand through his thin brown hair.
Even with a peace banner, we were attacked twice. Wolves in mail, hungry to savage anyone weaker than themselves. The gods alone know what side they started on, but they're on their own side now. Lost 3 men and twice as many wounded.
What news of our foe? Tyrion turned his attention back to Stark's terms.
The boy does not want too much, only half the realm. The release of our captives, hostages, his father's sword, oh yes, and his sister's.
The boy sits idle at River Run, Sir Cleos said. I think he fears to face your father in the field. His strength grows less each day. The River Lords have departed, each to defend his own lands.
Is this what father intended?
Tyrion rolled up Stark's map. These terms will never do.
Will you at least consent to trade the Stark girls for Teon and Willem?
Sir Cleos asked plaintively. Teon Frey was his younger brother, Tyrion recalled.
No, he said gently, but we'll propose our own exchange of captives.
Let me consult with Cersei and the Council. We shall send you back to River Run with our terms. Clearly the prospect did not cheer him.
My lord, I do not believe Robb Stark will yield easily. It is Lady Catelyn who wants this peace, not the boy.
Lady Catelyn wants her daughters. Tyrion pushed himself down from the bench, letter and map in hand. Sir Jaslyn will see that you have food and fire. You look in dire need of sleep, cousin. I will send for you when we know more. He found Sir Jaslyn on the ramparts, watching several hundred new recruits drilling in the field below. With so many seeking refuge in King's Landing, there was no lack of men willing to join the city watch for a full belly and a bed of straw in the barracks. But Tyrion had no illusions about how well these ragged defenders of theirs would fight if it came to battle.
You did well to send for me, Tyrion said. I shall leave Sir Cleos in your hands. He is to have every hospitality.
And his escort? The commander wanted to know.
Give them food and clean garb, and find a maester to see to their hurts. They are not to set foot inside the city, is that understood?
It would never do to have the truth of conditions in King's Landing reach Robb Stark in River Run.
Well understood, my lord. Oh, and one more thing. The alchemists will be sending a large supply of clay pots to each of the city gates. You're to use them to train the men who will work your spitfires. Fill the pots with green paint and have them drill at loading and firing. Any man who sputters should be replaced. When they have mustered the paint pots, substitute lamp oil and have them work at lighting the jars and firing them while aflame. Once they learn to do that without burning themselves, they may be ready for wildfire.
Sir Jaslyn scratched his cheek with his iron hand. Wise measures, though I have no love for that alchemist piss.
Nor I, but I use what I'm given.
Once back inside his litter, Tyrion Lannister drew the curtains and plumped a cushion under his elbow.
Cersei would be displeased to learn that he had intercepted Stark's letter, but his father had sent him here to rule, not to please Cersei.
It seemed to him that Robb Stark had given them a golden chance. Let the boy wait at Riverrun, dreaming of an easy peace. Tyrion would reply with terms of his own, giving the king in the north just enough of what he wanted to keep him hopeful. Let Sir Cleos wear out his bony, fray rump, riding to and fro with offers and counters. All the while, their cousin, Sir Stafford, would be training and arming the new host he'd raised at Casterly Rock. Once he was ready, he and Lord Tywin could smash the Tullys and Starks between them. Now, if only Robert's brothers would be so accommodating. Glacial as his progress was, still Renly Baratheon crept north and east with his huge southern host, and scarcely a night passed that Tyrion did not dread being awakened with the news that Lord Stannis was sailing his fleet up the Blackwater Rush. Well, it would seem I have a goodly stock of wildfire, but still... The sound of some hubbub in the street intruded on his worries. Tyrion peered out cautiously between the curtains. They were passing through Cobbler's Square, where a sizable crowd had gathered beneath the leather awnings to listen to the rantings of a prophet. A robe of undyed wool belted with a hempen rope marked him for one of the begging brothers.
Corruption!
The man shouted shrilly.
There is a warning! Behold the Father Scourge!
He pointed at the fuzzy red wound in the sky. From this vantage, the distant castle on Aegon's High Hill was directly behind him, with the comet hanging forebodingly over its towers.
A clever choice of stage, Tyrion reflected.
We have become swollen, bloated, foul, brother couples with sister in the bed of kings, and the fruit of their incest keepers in his palace to the piping of a twisted little monkey demon. Highborn ladies fornicate with fools and give birth to monsters. Even the High Septon has forgotten the gods he bathes in scented waters and grows fat on lark and lamprey while his people starve. Pride comes before prayer. Maggots rule our castles, and gold is all, but no more. The rotten summer is at an end, and the whoremonger king is brought low. When the boar did open him, a great stench rose to heaven, and a thousand snakes slid forth from his belly, hissing and biting.
He jabbed his bony finger back at comet and castle.
There comes the harbinger. Cleanse yourselves. The gods cry out, lest ye be cleansed. Bathe in the wine of righteousness, or you will be bathed in fire. Fire! Fire!
Other voices echoed, but the hoots of derision almost drowned them out. Tyrion took solace from that. He gave the command to continue, and the litter rocked like a ship on a rough sea as the burned men cleared a path.
Twisted little monkey demon, indeed.
The wretch did have a point about the High Septon, to be sure. What was it that Moonboy had said of him the other day?
A pious man who worships the seven so fervently that he eats a meal for each of them whenever he sits to table.
The memory of the fool's jape made Tyrion smile. He was pleased to reach the Red Keep without further incident. As he climbed the steps to his chambers, Tyrion felt a deal more hopeful than he had at dawn.
Time, that is all I truly need. Time to piece it all together. Once the chain is done...
He opened the door to his solar. Cersei turned away from the window, her skirts swirling around her slender hips. How dare you ignore my summons?
Who admitted you to my tower?
Your tower? This is my son's royal castle.
So they tell me.
Tyrion was not amused. Crawn would be even less so. His moon brothers had the guard today.
I was about to come to you, as it happens.
Were you? He swung the door shut behind him.
You doubt me?
Always. And with good reason.
Oh, I'm hurt.
Tyrion waddled to the sideboard for a cup of wine. He knew no surer way to work up a thirst than talking with Cersei. If I've given you offence, I would know how. What a disgusting little worm you are. Marcella is my only daughter. Did you truly imagine that I would allow you to sell her like a bag of oats?
Marcella, he thought. Well, that egg has hatched. Let's see what colour the chick is.
Hardly a bag of oats. Marcella is a princess. Some would say this is what she was born for. Or did you plan to marry her to Tommen? Her hand lashed out, knocking the wine cup from his hand to spill on the floor. Brother or no, I should have your tongue out for that. I am Joffrey's regent, not you. And I say that Marcella will not be shipped off to this Dornishman the way I was shipped off to Robert Baratheon. Tyrion shook the wine off his fingers and sighed. Why not? She'd be a deal safer in Dorne than she is here. Are you utterly ignorant or simply perverse? You know as well as I that the Martells have no cause to love us. The Martells have every cause to hate us. Nonetheless, I expect them to agree. Prince Doran's grievance against House Lannister goes back only a generation, but the Dornishmen have warred against Storm's End and Highgarden for 1,000 years, and Renly has taken Dorne's allegiance for granted. Marcella is 9, Tristane Martell 11. I have proposed they wed when she reaches her 14th year. Until such time, she would be an honored guest at Sunspear under Prince Doran's protection. A hostage, Cersei said, mouth tightening.
An honored guest,
Tyrion insisted.
And I suspect Martell will treat Marcella more kindly than Joffrey has treated Sansa Stark. I had in mind to send Sir Aerys O'Carte with her. With a Knight of the King's Guard as her sworn shield, no one is like to forget who or what she is.
Small good Sir Aerys will do her if Doran Martell decides that my daughter's death would wash out his sister's.
Martell is too honorable to murder a 9-year-old girl, particularly one as sweet and innocent as Marcella. So long as he holds her, he can be reasonably certain that we'll keep faith on our side, and the terms are too rich to refuse. Marcella is the least part of it. I've also offered him his sister's killer, a council seat, some castles on the marches.
Too much. Cersei paced away from him, restless as a lioness, skirts swirling. You've offered too much, and without my authority or consent.
This is the Prince of Dorne we are speaking of. If I'd offered less, he'd likely spit in my face.
Too much, Cersei insisted, whirling back.
What would you have offered him? That hole between your legs?
Tyrion said, his own anger flaring. This time, he saw the slap coming. His head snapped around with a crack.
Sweet, sweet sister, he said. I promise you that was the last time you will ever strike me.
His sister laughed. Don't threaten me, little man. Do you think Father's letter keeps you safe? A piece of paper. Eddard Stark had a piece of paper, too, for all the good it did him.
Eddard Stark did not have the city watch, Tyrion thought, nor my clansmen, nor the sellswords that Brunn has hired. I do.
Or so he hoped, trusting in Varys, in Sir Jaslyn Bywater, in Brunn. Lord Stark had probably had his delusions as well. Yet he said nothing. A wise man did not pour wildfire on a brazier. Instead, he poured a fresh cup of wine.
How safe do you think Marcella will be if King's Landing falls? Renly and Stannis will mount her head beside yours.
And Cersei began to cry. Tyrion Lannister could not have been more astonished if Aegon the Conqueror himself had burst into the room riding on a dragon and juggling lemon pies. He had not seen his sister weep since they were children together at Castle Rock. Awkwardly, he took a step toward her. When your sister cries, you were supposed to comfort her, but this was Cersei. He reached a tentative hand for her shoulder.
Don't touch me, she said, wrenching away.
It should not have hurt, yet it did, more than any slap. Red-faced, as angry as she was grief-stricken, Cersei struggled for breath.
Don't look at me. Not like this. Not you.
Politely, Tyrion turned his back. I did not mean to frighten you. I promise you, nothing will happen to Marcella.
Liar, she said behind him. I'm not a child to be soothed with empty promises. You tell me you would free Jaime too. Well, where is he?
In Riverrun, I should imagine, safe and under guard, until I find a way to free him.
Cersei sniffed. I should have been born a man. I would have no need for any of you then. None of this would have been allowed to happen. How could Jaime let himself be captured by that boy? And father, I trusted in him, fool that I am. But where is he now that he's wanted? What is he doing?
Making war. From behind the walls of Harrenhal, she said scornfully. A curious way of fighting. It looks suspiciously like hiding.
Look again. What else would you call it? Father sits in one castle and Robb Stark sits in another, and no one does anything?
There is sitting, and there is sitting,
Tyrion suggested.
Each one waits for the other to move, but the lion is still poised, his tail twitching, while the fawn is frozen by fear. Boughs turn to jelly. No matter which way he bounds, the lion will have him, and he knows it.
And you're quite certain that father is the lion?
Tyrion grinned. It's on all our banners.
She ignored the jest.
If it was father who had been taken captive, Jaime would not be sitting by idly, I promise you. Jaime would be battering his host to bloody bits against the walls of Riverrun, and the others take their chances. He never did have any patience, no more than you, sweet sister. Not all of us can be as bold as Jaime, but there are other ways to win wars. Harrenhal is strong and well situated.
And King's Landing is not, as we both know perfectly well. While father plays lion and fawn with the Stark boy, Renly marches up the Rose Road. He could be at our gates any day now.
The city will not fall in a day. From Harrenhal, it is a straight, swift march down the King's Road. Renly will scarce have unlimbered his siege engines before father takes him in the rear. His host will be the hammer, the city walls the anvil. It makes a lovely picture.
Cersei's green eyes bored into him, wary, yet hungry for the reassurance he was feeding her.
And if Robb Stark marches? Harrenhal is close enough to the fords of the Trident so that Roose Bolton cannot bring the northern foot across to join with the young wolf's horse. Stark cannot march on King's Landing without taking Harrenhal first, and even with Bolton, he is not strong enough to do that.
Tyrion tried his most winning smile.
Meanwhile, father lives off the fat of the riverlands, while our uncle Stafford gathers fresh levies at the rock.
Cersei regarded him suspiciously. How could you know all this? Did father tell you his intentions when he sent you here?
No. I glanced at a map.
Her look turned to disdain.
You've conjured up every word of this in that grotesque head of yours, haven't you, imp?
Tyrion tisked.
Sweet sister, I ask you, if we weren't winning, would the Starks have sued for peace?
He drew out the letter that Sir Cleos Frey had brought.
The young wolf has sent us terms, you see. Unacceptable terms, to be sure, but still a beginning. Would you care to see them?
Yes. That fast she was all queen again. How do you come to have them? They should have come to me.
What else is a hand for, if not to hand you things?
Tyrion handed her the letter. His cheeks still throbbed, where Cersei's hand had left its mark.
Let her flay half my face. It will be a small price to pay for her consent to the Dornish marriage. He would have that now. He could sense it.
And certain knowledge of an informer, too.
Well, that was the plum in his pudding.
Bran. Dancer was draped in bardings of snowy white wool emblazoned with the grey direwolf of House Stark, while Bran wore grey breeches and white doublet, his sleeves and collar trimmed with vair. Over his heart was the wolf's head brooch of silver and polished jet. He would sooner have had summer than a silver wolf on his breast, but Sir Roderick had been unyielding. The low stone steps balked Dancer only for a moment. When Bran urged her on, she took them easily. Beyond the wide oaken iron doors, 8 long rows of trestle tables filled Winterfell's great hall, 4 on each side of the center aisle. Men crowded shoulder to shoulder on the benches. "Stark!" they called as Bran trotted past, rising to their feet. "Winterfell! Winterfell!" He was old enough to know that it was not truly him they shouted for. It was the harvest they cheered. It was Rob and his victories. It was his Lord Father and his grandfather and all the Starks going back 8,000 years. Still, it made him swell with pride. For so long as it took him to ride the length of that hall, he forgot that he was broken. Yet when he reached the dais, with every eye upon him, Osha and Hodor undid his straps and buckles, lifted him off Dancer's back, and carried him to the high seat of his father's. Sir Roderick was seated to Bran's left, his daughter Beth beside him. Rickon was to his right, his mop of shaggy auburn hair grown so long that it brushed his ermine mantle. He had refused to let anyone cut it since their mother had gone. The last girl to try had been bitten for her efforts. "I wanted to ride too," he said as Hodor led Dancer away. "I ride better than you." "You don't, so hush up," he told his brother. Sir Roderick bellowed for quiet. Bran raised his voice. He bid them welcome in the name of his brother, the king in the north, and asked them to thank the gods, old and new, for Rob's victories and the bounty of the harvest. "May there be 100 more," he finished, raising his father's silver goblet. 100 more! Pewter tankards, clay cups, and iron-banded drinking horns clashed together. Bran's wine was sweetened with honey and fragrant with cinnamon and cloves, but stronger than he was used to. He could feel its hot, snaky fingers wriggling through his chest as he swallowed. By the time he set down the goblet, his head was swimming. "You did well, Bran," Sir Roderick told him. "Lord Eddard would have been most proud." Down the table, Maester Lewin nodded his agreement as the servers began to carry in the food. Such food Bran had never seen, course after course after course, so much that he could not manage more than a bite or two of each dish. There were great joints of oryx roasted with leeks, venison pies chunky with carrots, bacon and mushrooms, mutton chops sauced in honey and cloves, savory duck, peppered boar, goose, skewers of pigeon and capon, beef and barley stew, cold fruit soup. Lord Wyman had brought 20 casks of fish from White Harbor, packed in salt and seaweed, whitefish and winkles, crabs and mussels, clams, heron, cod, salmon, lobster and lampreys. There was black bread and honey cakes and oaten biscuits. There were turnips and peas and beets, beans and squash and huge red onions. There were baked apples and berry tarts and pears poached in strong wine. Wheels of white cheese were set at every table, above and below the salt, and flagons of hot spice wine and chilled autumn ale were passed up and down the tables. Lord Wyman's musicians played bravely and well, but harp and fiddle and horn were soon drowned beneath a tide of talk and laughter, the clash of cup and plate, and the snarling of hounds fighting for table scraps. The singer sang good songs, Iron Lances, and The Burning of the Ships, and The Bear and the Maiden Fair, but only Hodor seemed to be listening. He stood beside the piper, hopping from one foot to the other. The noise swelled to a steady rumbling roar, a great heady stew of sound. Sir Roderick talked with Maester Lewin above Beth's curly head while Rickon screamed happily at the Walders. Bran had not wanted the phrase at the high table, but the maester reminded him that they would soon be kin. Rob was to marry one of their aunts, and Arya one of their uncles. She never will, Bran said. Not Arya. But Maester Luwin was unyielding, so there they were beside Rickon. The serving men brought every dish to Bran first that he might take the lord's portion if he chose. By the time they reached the ducks, he could eat no more. After that, he nodded approval at each course in turn and waved it away. If the dish smelt especially choice, he would send it to one of the lords on the dais, a gesture of friendship and favor that Maester Luwin told him he must make. He sent some salmon down to poor, sad Lady Hornwood, the boar to the boisterous Umbers, a dish of goose and berries to Clay Serwin, and a huge lobster to Joseph, the master of horse, who was neither lord nor guest, but had seen to dancers' training and made it possible for Bran to ride. He sent sweets to Hodor and Old Nan as well, for no reason, but he loved them. Sir Roderick reminded him to send something to his foster brothers, so he sent Little Walder some boiled beets and Big Walder the buttered turnips. On the benches below, Winterfell men mixed with small folk from the Winter Town, friends from the nearer Holdfast, and the escorts of their lordly guests. Some faces Bran had never seen before, others he knew as well as his own, yet they all seemed equally foreign to him. He watched them as from a distance, as if he still sat in the window of his bedchamber, looking down on the yard below, seeing everything, yet a part of nothing. Usher moved among the tables, pouring ale. One of Leobald Tallheart's men slid a hand up under her skirts, and she broke the flagon over his head to roars of laughter. Yet Mickon had his hand down some woman's bodice, and she seemed not to mind. Bran watched Farlan make his red bitch beg for bones and smiled at Old Nan plucking at the crust of a hot pie with wrinkled fingers. On the dais, Lord Wyman attacked a steaming plate of lampreys as if they were an enemy host. He was so fat that Sir Roderick had commanded that a special wide chair be built for him to sit in. But he laughed loud and often, and Bran thought he liked him. Poor one Lady Hornwood sat beside him, her face a stony mask, as she picked listlessly at her food. At the opposite end of the high table, Hothan and Mors were playing a drinking game, slamming their horns together as hard as knights meeting in joust. It is too hot here, and too noisy, and they're all getting drunk. Bran itched under his grey and white woolens, and suddenly he wished he were anywhere but here. It is cool in the Godswood now. Steam is rising off the hot pools, and the red leaves of the weirwood are rustling. The smells are richer than here, and before long the moon will rise, and my brother will sing to it.
Bran, Sir Roderick said, you do not eat.
The waking dream had been so vivid. For a moment, Bran had not known where he was. I'll have more later, he said. My belly's full to bursting. The old knight's white moustache was pink with wine.
You have done well, Bran. Here and at the audiences. You will be an especially fine lord one day, I think.
I want to be a knight. Bran took another sip of the spiced honey wine from his father's goblet, grateful for something to clutch. The lifelike head of a snarling direwolf was raised on the side of the cup. He felt the silver muzzle pressing against his palm, and remembered the last time he had seen his lord father drink from this goblet. It had been the night of the welcoming feast, when King Robert had brought his court to Winterfell. Summer still reigned then. His parents had shared the dais with Robert and his queen, with her brothers beside her. Uncle Benjen had been there too, all in black. Bran and his brothers and sisters sat with the king's children, Joffrey and Tommen, and Princess Myrcella, who spent the whole meal gazing at Rob with adoring eyes. Arya made faces across the table when no one was looking. Sansa listened raptly, while the king's high harper sang songs of chivalry, and Rickon kept asking why John wasn't with them. Because he's a bastard, Bran finally had to whisper to him. And now they are all gone. It was as if some cruel god had reached down with a great hand and swept them all away. The girls to captivity, John to the wall, Rob and Mother to war, King Robert and Father to their graves, and perhaps Uncle Benjamin as well. Even down on the benches, there were new men at the tables. Jory was dead, and Fat Tom, and Porter, Alan, Desmond, Holland, who had been master of horse, Harwin, his son, all those who had gone south with his father, even Septim Ordain and Vaean Poole. The rest had ridden to war with Rob, and might soon be dead as well, for all Bran knew. He liked Hayhead and Poxy Tim and Skittrick and the other new men well enough, but he missed his old friends. He looked up and down the benches at all the faces, happy and sad, and wondered who would be missing next year and the year after. He might have cried then, but he couldn't. He was the Stark in Winterfell, his father's son and his brother's heir, and almost a man grown. At the foot of the hall, the doors opened, and a gust of cold air made the torches flame brighter for an instant. Alebelly led two new guests into the feast.
The Lady Mira of House Reed, the rotund guardsman bellowed over the clamber, with her brother, Jojen, and Greywater Watch.
Men looked up from their cups and trenchers to eye the newcomers. Bran heard Little Walder mutter, "Frog eaters," to Big Walder beside him. Sir Roderick climbed to his feet.
"Be welcome, friends, and share this harvest with us."
Serving men hurried to lengthen the tables on the dais, fetching trestles and chairs.
"Who are they?"
Rickon asked.
"Mud men," answered Little Walder disdainfully. "They're thieves and cravens, and they have green teeth from eating frogs."
Maester Lewin crouched beside Bran's seat to whisper counsel in his ear.
"You must greet these ones warmly. I had not thought to see them here, but you know who they are."
Bran nodded. "Crannog men from the Neck."
"Howland Reed was a great friend to your father," Sir Roderick told him. "These two are his, it would seem."
As the newcomers walked the length of the hall, Bran saw that one was indeed a girl, though he would never have known it from her dress. She wore lambskin breeches soft with long use and a sleeveless jerkin armoured in bronze scales. Though near Rob's age, she was slim as a boy, with long brown hair knotted behind her head and only the barest suggestion of breasts. A woven net hung from one slim hip, a long bronze knife from the other. Under her arm she carried an old iron great helm spotted with rust, a frog spear and round leathern shield was strapped to her back. Her brother was several years younger and bore no weapons. All his garb was green, even to the leather of his boots, and when he came closer, Bran saw that his eyes were the colour of musk, though his teeth looked as white as anyone else's. Both Reeds were slight of build, slender as swords and scarcely taller than Bran himself. They went to one knee before the dais.
"My lords of Stark," the girl said, "the years have passed in their hundreds and their thousands since my folk first swore their fealty to the king in the north. My lord father has sent us here to say the words again for all our people."
"She is looking at me," Bran realized. He had to make some answer.
"My brother Rob is fighting in the south," he said, "but you can say your words to me if you like." "To Winterfell we pledge the faith of Greywater," they said together. "Hearth and heart and harvest we yield up to you, my lord. Our swords and spears and arrows are yours to command. Grant mercy to our weak, help to our helpless, and justice to all, and we shall never fail you." "I swear it by earth and water," said the boy in green. "I swear it by bronze and iron," his sister said. "We swear it by ice and fire," they finished together.
Bran groped for words. Was he supposed to swear something back to them? Their oath was not one he had been taught. "May your winters be short and your summers bountiful," he said. That was usually a good thing to say. "Rise, I'm Brandon Stark." The girl, Mira, got to her feet and helped her brother up. The boy stared at Bran all the while.
"We bring you gifts of fish and frog and fowl," he said.
"I thank you." Bran wondered if he would have to eat a frog to be polite. "I offer you the meat and mead of Winterfell." He tried to recall all he had been taught of the Crannog men, who dwelt among the bugs of the neck and seldom left their wetlands. They were a poor folk, fishers and frog hunters, who lived in houses of thatch and woven reed on floating islands hidden in the deeps of the swamp. It was said that they were a cowardly people who fought with poisoned weapons and preferred to hide from their foes rather than face them in open battle. And yet Halen Reed had been one of Father's staunchest companions during the war for King Robert's crown, before Bran was born. The boy, Jojen, looked about the hall curiously as he took his seat. "Where are the direwolves?"
"In the guard's wood," Rickon answered. "Shaggy was bad." "My brother would like to see them," the girl said.
Little Alder spoke up loudly.
"Ed, best watch they don't see him, or they'll take a bite out of him."
"They won't bite if I'm here." Bran was pleased that they wanted to see the wolves. "Summer won't anyway, and he'll keep Shaggy Dog away." He was curious about these mudmen. He could not recall ever seeing one before. His father had sent letters to the Lord of Greywater over the years, but none of the Crannog men had ever called at Winterfell. He would have liked to talk to them more, but the Great Hall was so noisy that it was hard to hear anyone who wasn't right beside you. Sir Roderick was right beside Bran. "Do they truly eat frogs?" he asked the old knight.
"Aye," Sir Roderick said. "Frogs and fish and lizard lions and all manner of birds."
"Maybe they don't have sheep and cattle," Bran thought. He commanded the serving men to bring them mutton chops and a slice off the oryx and fill their trenchers with beef and barley stew. They seemed to like that well enough. The girl caught him staring at her and smiled. Bran blushed and looked away. Much later, after all the sweets had been served and washed down with gallons of summer wine, the food was cleared and the tables shoved back against the walls to make room for the dancing. The music grew wilder, the drummers joined in, and Hother Umber brought forth a huge curved war horn banded in silver. When the singer reached the part in The Night That Ended, where the Night's Watch rode forth to meet the others in the battle for the dawn, he blew a blast that set all the dogs to barking. Two Glover men began a spinning skirl on bladder and woodharp. Mors Umber was the first on his feet. He seized a passing servant girl by the arm, knocking the flagon of wine out of her hands to shatter on the floor. Amidst the rushes and bones and bits of bread that littered the stone, he whirled her and spun her and tossed her in the air. The girl squealed with laughter and turned red as her skirt swirled and lifted. Others soon joined in. Hodor began to dance all by himself, while Lord Wyman asked little Beth Cassell to partner him. For all his size, he moved gracefully. When he tired, Clay Serwyn danced with a child in his stead. Sir Roderick approached Lady Hornwood, but she made her excuses and took her leave. Bran watched long enough to be polite, and then had Hodor summoned. He was hot and tired, flushed from the wine, and the dancing made him sad. It was something else he could never do. "I want to go."
"Hodor!"
Hodor shouted back, kneeling. Maester Lewin and Hayhead lifted him into his basket. The folk of Winterfell had seen this sight 50 times, but doubtless it looked queer to the guests, some of whom were more curious than polite. Bran felt the stares. They went out the rear rather than walk the length of the hall, Bran ducking his head as they passed through the Lord's door. In the dim-lit gallery outside the Great Hall, they came upon Joseph, the master of horse, engaged in a different sort of riding. He had some woman, Brand did not know, shoved up against the wall, her skirts around her waist. She was giggling until Hodor stopped to watch. Then she screamed. "Leave them be, Hodor," Brand had to tell him. "Take me to my bedchamber." Hodor carried him up the winding steps to his tower and knelt beside one of the iron bars that Mikkon had driven into the wall. Bran used the bars to move himself to the bed, and Hodor pulled off his boots and breeches. "You can go back to the feast now, but don't go bothering Joseph and that woman," Bran said.
"Hodor,"
Hodor replied, bobbing his head. When he blew out his bedside candle, darkness covered him like a soft, familiar blanket, the faint sound of music drifting through his shuttered window. Something his father had told him once, when he was little, came back to him suddenly. He had asked Lord Eddard if the King's Guard were truly the finest knights in the Seven Kingdoms. "No longer," he answered, "but once they were a marvel, a shining lesson to the world. Was there one who was best of all? The finest knight I ever saw was Sir Arthur Dane, who fought with a blade called Dawn, forged from the heart of a fallen star. They called him the Sword of the Morning, and he would have killed me but for Howland Reed." Father had gotten sad then, and he would say no more. Bran wished he had asked him what he meant. He went to sleep with his head full of knights in gleaming armor, fighting with swords that shone like star fire. But when the dream came, he was in the Godswood again. The smells from the kitchen and the great hall were so strong that it was almost as if he had never left the feast. He prowled beneath the trees, his brother close behind him. This night was wildly alive, full of the howling of the man pack at their play. The sounds made him restless. He wanted to run, to hunt. He wanted to... The rattle of iron made his ears prick up. His brother heard it too. They raced through the undergrowth toward the sound. Bounding across the still water at the foot of the old white one, he caught the scent of a stranger. The man smell, well mixed with leather and earth and iron. The intruders had pushed a few yards into the wood when he came upon them, a female and a young male, with no taint of fear to them, even when he showed them the white of his teeth. His brother growled low in his throat, yet still they did not run.
"Here they come," the female said.
"Mira," some part of him whispered, some wisp of the sleeping boy lost in the wolf dream.
"Did you know they would be so big?" "They will be bigger still before they're grown," the young male said, watching them with eyes large, green, and unafraid. "The black one is full of fear and rage, but the gray is strong, stronger than he knows. Can you feel him, sister?"
"No," she said, moving a hand to the hilt of the long brown knife she wore.
"Go careful, Jojen. He won't hurt me. This is not the day I die."
The male walked toward them, unafraid, and reached out for his muzzle, a touch as light as a summer breeze. Yet at the brush of those fingers, the wood dissolved, and the very ground turned to smoke beneath his feet and swirled away laughing. And then he was spinning and falling, falling, falling. Catelyn. As she slept amidst the rolling grasslands, Catelyn dreamt that Bran was whole again, that Arya and Sansa held hands, that Rickon was still a babe at her breast, Robb, crownless, played with a wooden sword, and when all were safe asleep, she found Ned in her bed, smiling. Sweet it was, sweet, and gone too soon. Dawn came cruel, a dagger of light. She woke aching and alone and weary, weary of riding, weary of hurting, weary of duty. "I want to weep," she thought. "I want to be comforted. I'm so tired of being strong.
I want to be foolish and frightened for once. Just for a small while, that's all. A day, an hour.
Outside her tent, men were stirring. She heard the whicker of horses, Shad complaining of stiffness in his back, Sir Wendell calling for his bow. Catelyn wished they would all go away. They were good men, loyal, yet she was tired of them all. It was her children she yearned after. One day, she promised herself as she lay abed, one day she would allow herself to be less than strong. But not today. It could not be today. Her fingers seemed more clumsy than usual as she fumbled on her clothes. She supposed she ought to be grateful that she had any use of her hands at all. The dagger had been Valyrian steel, and Valyrian steel bites deep and sharp. She had only to look at the scars to remember. Outside, Shad was stirring oats into a kettle, while Sir Wendell Mandelier sat stringing his bow.
"My lady," he said, when Catelyn emerged, "there are birds in this grass. Would you fancy a roast quail to break your fast this morning?"
"Oats and bread are sufficient for all of us, I think. We have many leagues yet to ride, Sir Wendell."
"As you will, my lady."
The knight's moon face looked crestfallen, the tips of his great walrus moustache twitching with disappointment.
"Oats and bread, what could be better?"
He was one of the fattest men Catelyn had ever known. But however much he loved his food, he loved his honour more.
"I found some nettles and brewed a tea," Shad announced. "Will my lady take a cup?"
"Yes, with thanks." She cradled the tea in her scarred hands and blew on it to cool it. Shad was one of the Winterfell men. Rob had sent 20 of his best to see her safely to Renly. He had sent 5 lordlings as well, whose names and high birth would add weight and honor to her mission. As they made their way south, staying well clear of towns and holdfasts, they had seen bands of mailed men more than once, and glimpsed smoke on the eastern horizon. But none had dared molest them. They were too weak to be a threat, too many to be easy prey. Once across the Blackwater, the worst was behind. For the past 4 days, they had seen no signs of war. Catelyn had never wanted this. She told Rob as much back in Riverrun. "When last I saw Renly, he was a boy no older than Bran. I do not know him. Send someone else. My place is here with my father for whatever time he has left." Her son had looked at her unhappily. "There is no one else. I cannot go myself. Your father's too ill. The Blackfish is my eyes and ears. I dare not lose him. Your brother I need to hold River Run when we march." March? No one had said a word to her of marching. "I cannot sit at River Run waiting for peace. It makes me look as if I were afraid to take the field again." When there are no battles to fight, men start to think of hearth and harvest. Father told me that. Even my Northmen grow restless. "My Northmen," she thought. "He's even starting to talk like a king." No one has ever died of restlessness, but rashness is another matter. We've planted seeds. Let them grow. Rob shook his head stubbornly. "We've tossed some seed into the wind, that's all. If your sister Lysa was coming to aid us, we would have heard by now. How many birds have we sent to the Eyrie? 4? I want peace too, but why should the Lannisters give me anything if all I do is sit here while my army melts away around me as swift as summer snow?" "So, rather than look craven, you will dance to Lord Tywin's pipes," she threw back. "He wants you to march on Harrenhal. Ask your Uncle Brynden if..." "I said nothing of Harrenhal," Rob said. "Now will you go to Renly for me, or must I send the Great John?" The memory brought a wan smile to her face. Such an obvious ploy, that. Yet deft for a boy of 15. Rob knew how ill-suited a man like Great John Umber would be to treat with a man like Renly Baratheon, and he knew that she knew it as well. What could she do but accede, praying that her father would live until her return? Had Lord Huster been well, he would have gone himself, she knew. Still, that leave-taking was hard. Hard. He did not even know her when she came to say farewell.
Minister,
he called her.
Where are...